Welcome to the Guardian Mindset Podcast, presented by attorney Eric Daigle.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the next episode of the Guardian Mindset Podcast. This is attorney Eric Daigle. And today we're going to be diving into the critical case that has serious implications for law enforcement professionals, a case called Barnes versus Felix, which currently is sitting in the Supreme Court after oral argument, which I am going to strongly encourage you to listen to. But let me do my share. And I think this case is very valuable. A lot of you know that I spend a lot of time focusing and training on use of force issues across the country. And more importantly, Daigle Law Group here, as this podcast is hosted by our DLG Learning Center and our summits. And as you know, yearly, we have our Use of Force Summit, which is an in-person training program at Mohegan Sun, attended by about 1,000 law enforcement corrections professionals from across the country. It's a really great event, very focused on everybody that has anything to do with force investigations, force analysis. And we focus on, at our Use of Force Summit, we focus on command, we focus on corrections, we focus on legal, we focus on training, and we focus on investigation. So this year in November at our 2024 Use of Force Summit, I was able to begin to talk about the case of Barnes versus Felix. But it wasn't until January of this year, specifically January 22nd, 2025, where the Supreme Court had oral argument on this matter. And it was a phenomenal oral argument, but it's dealing with some very crucial issues addressing use of force. We think we know how this is going to turn out based on the way the oral argument went, but you never know. So stand by. Let me go through this with you. And if you're an officer, this podcast has value to you across the different applications, because really what we're going to talk about here is that go to totality of the circumstances situation. In this case, specifically deals with totality of the circumstances in versus a moment of threat and what that application is. Now, we all know that 2020, with the death of George Floyd, brought again use of force analysis into review. And then we went into 2021 and 2022 with a lot of confusion across 30 plus states in this country as legislatures, I hate to use the word, but I will, manipulated use of force application. I'm a pretty straightforward guy, as you all know. And when we talk about use of force application, the guidance on use of force, as we all know, comes to us from the Supreme Court. Our foundational cases of Tennessee versus Garner in 1985 and Graham versus Connor in 1989 have long been the standing application. And before we went to police reform, which I think was intentionally done to add some more confusion to this issue, before we did that, you know, my number one thing for the last 10 years in the Use of Force Summit is on year 14, and my involvement in force-related issues such as investigations and training and after actions, all of that stuff. I would say very clearly that I thought that that use of force should be the only policy, that every department in this country has the exact same policy. We have to do that. Why? Well, because, you know, one of the things that, you know, if somebody makes a statement that's as bold as that, which, you know, you want to be able to back it up. I'm not one of those guys that's going to sit here and pontificate about my theories. So how do I back that up? Well, as a litigator, one of the things that I know is that as we go throughout the country, if I go to federal courts and I go to federal jury instructions, and you all know that, you know, when you have a litigation case, the last thing that occurs before the jury goes into the deliberation room is that they are charged by the judicial authority, by the judge. And what that means is that if you've ever been involved in it, they lock the doors of the courtroom so nobody disturbs the judge, and the judge reviews the law in the case. And it's a very, very important thing in use of force analysis, because what we all know is by the time the jury is completed getting the evidence in the case, the one thing they haven't gotten is how to evaluate the use of force, right? What is the basis of evaluation? And they often are very confused in my experience as a litigator. And it really is not until we get to closing argument where we begin to explain to them the need to have clarity on the issue of the legal interpretation. You know, how do they remember the jury is asked a very simple question. How do we determine if the officer, deputies, troopers' use of force was objectively reasonable? And we know that that's not an easy analysis, but it is well articulated by the applications of the legal arena, that is the separation of non-deadly and deadly force in its application, right? We have Graham versus Connor. Severity of the crime, the threat to the officer or others, whether the subject is actively resisting or attempting to evade arrest by flight. And in the deadly force application, we have the aspects of imminent threat of serious physical harm or death. And so for years, if you look at the jury charges in every state in this country, the federal jury charges, you will see that every state, 49 of them anyway, because California is special, we know that, but they have an extra line in theirs. But the aspect of that is that it's focusing on the fact that that the jury instructions are almost identical. And that's a big point for me, because if the jury instructions are almost identical, then why? That's the question. Why is everybody's policy different? Why? Well, you know, I've said this in training over and over again, and my love of use of force analysis is that human nature kicks in, right? Human beings mess things up. That's just a key aspect to human beings. They mess things up. And everybody wants to be special. Everybody wants to do it their way. You get the DT instructors involved. You get, guys, I love you all. I will hug you all. But the reality of use of force is until we as a country start focusing on the legal interpretations and applications, we are going to be inconsistent, which is why I love the fact that this case, Barnes versus Felix, is back up in bringing this to the bringing these issues to limelight. Now, we know that in we've had some cases since Graham versus Connor and Tennessee versus Garner. We had the Kingsley decision in 2015, which is very applicable to corrections, but I like to teach that in force investigations because it asks some very specific questions. And those questions were again carried out in the per curiam decision on June 28, 2021, in the Lombardo decision. You can obviously find that in the podcast here, something we've been saying, but where the court really focused on consistency and clarification of their responsibility of those who use force to provide the totality of the circumstances. There's that word again. And that's what we're talking about before. So in the Lombardo per curiam decision, which basically means not a full decision, it was a kickback to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. The Eighth Circuit didn't look at the kneeling on the back of Mr. Gilbert in a consistent way of interpreting Graham versus Connor. That kneeling on the back was alleged to be part of what led to Mr. Gilbert's death. Yes, no, that's always open for interpretation. But the Supreme Court said, hey, hold on a second here. We are not going to just let you call the kneeling on the back insignificant. We're going to focus on clarification and making sure that we are addressing the totality of the circumstances. So before I dive into Barnes versus Felix, I want to just do a second to review Lombardo and Lombardo versus St. Louis, the per curiam decision, where the court said, hey, focus on the totality of the circumstances. And what they wanted in that totality of circumstances was the need for the officer's use of force and the officer to articulate why they needed to use the level of force that they did. And I think that's a very important structure here. So I'm going to take a second to make sure I refresh it on you. The need for the use of force, governmental interest under the Fourth Amendment. Why did you need to use force? And then the second part of that, which is, again, consistent with what the Supreme Court said in Kingsley in 2015, why did you need to use that level of force. Also in Lombardo, in totaling, talking about the totality of the circumstances, the court focused on the perception of the officer. And I love that because it's not the perception of the video. It's not the perception of other people. It's the perception of the decision maker in its application. And finally, in Lombardo, they talked about active resistance, right, and where that belongs, and that the need, the perception, and the active resistance should all make up totality of the circumstances. Well, here we come again, and we're going to deal with a Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals case that has made its way to the Supreme Court. And as I said, really talks about critical issues. That's why we call this a critical case that is serious implications for law enforcement professionals. So let me introduce you to Barnes versus Felix. Now, I will ask Erica to put on the podcast website the link to the video of Felix. You can just Google it and you will see it. I'm going to go over the facts here in a second. But let's talk about what this case is. This case involves the tragic death of Ashaun Barnes after a routine traffic stop. And the core question here is about the use of deadly force during police encounters. The Supreme Court is now reviewing, after oral argument, whether Officer Felix's actions when he shot Barnes during the traffic stop for unpaid tolls, was it in violation of the Fourth Amendment protections against unreasonable seizures? In this episode, we're not just talking about legal theory. We're going to break down what this case means for law enforcement officers in the field. We'll look at a split-second decision, use of force protocols, and a broader totality of the circumstances when you're out there making decisions under intense pressure. Now, in 2024, if you attended the Use of Force Summit, you know that the Use of Force Summit this year focused on we're dealing with police-created jeopardy. And that stems from years before dealing with mental health response, crisis response, duty of care, and then focusing on police-created jeopardy, putting ourselves in situations where the need to use deadly force is significant. And police-created jeopardy is a very specific application to this decision. So let's dive in first on the fact pattern here so that you can kind of get a feel for what we're doing here. So Officer Felix, acting on information received via a radio dispatch from the Harris County Toll Road Authority, identified and stopped a vehicle matching the description of a license plate that was reported to have outstanding violations. The officer approached the driver's side window and requested Barnes's driver's license and proof of insurance. Barnes replied that he did not have the documentation and that the car had been rented a week earlier in his girlfriend's name. During the interaction, Barnes was digging around in the car, and you can see the officer who's standing outside the car. Officer Felix warns Barnes, you can hear it on the transmission, he warns Barnes to stop doing that, stop digging around, and he starts to ask questions about marijuana. He claims that he smelled marijuana. As often does in these situations, at this point, the situation rapidly escalated, right? He then asked Barnes if he had anything in the vehicle, and Officer Felix should know about it. In response, Barnes turned off the car and placed his keys near the shifting gears. Barnes responded verbally, telling Officer Felix that he might have the requested documentation in the trunk of the car. If you review the body-worn camera footage, please push pause and Google that and watch it right now. It's literally about 35 seconds. He asked if Barnes had anything in the vehicle that Officer Felix should know about. He's turned off the car, and he told him that he might. The body-worn camera footage shared at this time that Barnes's left blinker is still on, indicating to anybody watching it that, hey, the keys may still be in the ignition. Barnes follows the officer's direction to open the trunk of the vehicle, followed by Barnes' left blinker turning off. Officer Felix asks Barnes to get out of the vehicle. He opens the door, and there is evidence that Barnes' driver's side door opens. You can see that. A few seconds later, Barnes' left blinker turns back on. Officer Felix drew his firearm. The body cam captures Officer Felix pointing his weapon at Barnes, in which he began shouting, Don't fucking move. Don't fucking move as Barnes' vehicle begins moving. However, with the door still open, Barnes began to drive away. And obviously, here's the critical situation. Officer Felix partially entered the vehicle. He steps up on, it looks like on the runner, on the side pan of the driver's door entry, enters the vehicle and ordered Barnes to stop. While the car was moving, Officer Felix shot inside the vehicle with no visibility as to where he is aiming. In the next second, Officer Felix fired another shot while the vehicle was still moving. He ended up discharging his firearm twice, resulting in Barnes's death. So as you would expect, Barnes's parents filed a lawsuit against the defendant, Officer Felix, in Harris County under 42 U.S.C. Section 1983. The parents argued that Officer Felix's use of force was unreasonable because even if Barnes attempted to flee, he did not pose a threat justifying deadly force. The district court, the lower court, granted the defendant's motion for summary judgment, finding that Officer Felix did not violate Barnes' constitutional rights and was entitled to qualified immunity. As you know, we've dealt with this many times. That's basically saying is that Officer Felix did not violate clearly established law. The district court found that Barnes posed a threat of serious harm to Officer Felix in the moment the car began to move. The lower court decision hinged on the perceived threat, which the court relied on to determine that the amount of force used by Officer Felix was reasonable and not excessive. The Barnes parents appealed to the Fifth Circuit. So we're in Texas, right? Let's look at what the Fifth Circuit had to say. On appeal, the Fifth Circuit affirmed the district court's decision granting summary judgment in favor of Officer Felix. When the case reached the Fifth Circuit, the key question was whether Officer Felix's use of deadly force was justified when it was employed and if he reasonably believed his life was in imminent danger. In the Fifth Circuit, it is well established that the excessive force inquiry is confined to whether the officers or other persons were in danger at the moment of the threat that resulted in the officer's use of deadly force. This moment of threat test means that the focus of the inquiry should be on the act that led the officers to discharge his weapon. As a result, any of the officers' actions leading up to the shooting are not relevant for the purpose of an excessive force analysis in the Fifth Circuit. Here, the district court here determined that the moment the threat occurred in the 2 seconds before Barnes was shot, at that time, Officer Felix was still hanging onto the moving vehicle and believed it would run him over, which could have made Officer Felix reasonably believe his life was in imminent danger. Going a step further, Officer Felix was still hanging on to the moving vehicle when he shot Barnes. This position placed the officer close to being run over, leading Officer Felix to believe his life was in imminent danger. Under the moment of threat test, Officer Felix did not violate Barnes' constitutional right. The Fifth Circuit's analysis was confined to the precise moment of threat. The Fifth Circuit affirmed the district court's grant of summary judgment, holding that no constitutional injury existed. Well, here we are on appeal to the Supreme Court. And one of the reasons why there's an appeal to the Supreme Court is because there is a conflict of the circuits specific as to moment of threat analysis versus the totality of the circumstances analysis. All right, that core issue is what's on the table here today and what the Supreme Court is focusing on looking at. So the fact that different circuits across the country look at this different, well, that's gonna need some legal background. So let's set the stage for some foundational legal knowledge. Under the Fourth Amendment, any seizure by law enforcement, whether it's an arrest or a stop, must be reasonable. We know that, right? In situations like traffic stop, officers have the right to detain someone, but the key is that the manner in which they seize someone must be proportionate to the threat they're facing. Now, this case brings up the concept of reasonableness, and particularly the moment of threat doctrine, which has come under scrutiny in this case. The Fifth Circuit ruled, as we said, that the only thing that matters in cases like this is the immediate moment of danger when the officer is under threat. they essentially said, well, we'll only look at seconds when the officer was in danger. But that's not the full picture, is it? And that's what the petitioner's legal team is arguing in this case, that to determine if force is reasonable, you need to understand not just the final seconds of an interaction, but the entire context leading up to the moment of the threat. Let's dig deeper into this moment of threat doctrine, because it's crucial for any law enforcement officer listening. The issue here is that this approach ignores context, right? It looks only at the final instant when the officer was in immediate danger. But listen, we know from experience and training that situations like this don't happen in a vacuum. They're a result of a buildup of circumstances. For example, in the Barnes case, Officer Felix had made a series of decisions leading up to the moment that Barnes tried to flee. The officer didn't consider alternative actions, like calling for backup or pursuing in a vehicle, instead choosing to jump on the car, which escalated the situation to deadly force. So, what do we know for this? How do we handle this? What can we learn from this? As law enforcement, you're trained to make split-second decisions, but it's important to recognize that every decision leading up to the threat matters. When you face a dangerous situation, you need to ask yourself, was this the only option available? Instead of jumping straight to force, pause and assess whether there's room for de-escalation in other alternatives. Now, let's take a look at what happened. So we had oral argument in the Supreme Court. And again, all you got to do is Google Barnes versus Felix Supreme Court. The oral argument pops up. It's about an hour and 15 minutes. I strongly encourage you to take a look at it. Let's look at some key questions that were asked during the course of this before we get into some recommendations here. We know that every case that goes to the Supreme Court goes with a question. The question here, as you probably got by now, is, was it correct for the Fifth Circuit to apply the moment of threat doctrine? And should courts instead consider pre-threat circumstances to determine reasonableness under the Fourth Amendment? There was three positions that were dealt with in this situation. The first was the petitioner. And the criticism of the petitioner regarding the Fifth Circuit's approach was that the moment of threat doctrine prevents courts from considering the officer's actions that may have escalated the situation. An example that we'll get back to that was talked about here was an officer who jumps in front of a moving vehicle and then shoots the driver should not be shielded from liability based solely on the moment the car posed a threat. The petitioner's argument was, this approach contradicts Graham versus Connor, which requires the totality of the circumstances. When they're looking at this application, the impact is, as the petitioner states, is that rigid application of the moment of threat doctrine creates dangerous precedents by excusing poor tactics and escalating behavior by officer. Now, this is something I've been jumping on for a while in the dealing with duty of care, in the dealing with mental health issues, and specifically in dealing with officer-created jeopardy. So let's go to the respondent. And the respondent is obviously the state here who is saying that the Fifth Circuit got it right. So they're going to defend the moment of threat doctrine. Their defense of the moment of threat doctrine focuses judicial inquiry on the immediate danger to the officer, avoiding speculative evaluation of prior actions. The respondent argues that expanding the inquiry undermines the objective reasonableness standard by introducing subjective assessments of the officer's mind. Interesting. I think what this shows in this case is that the respondents, the state, actually partially concedes to some of the petitioner's argument. The respondents acknowledge that the pre-threat circumstances might sometimes be relevant, but emphasizes that the moment of the threat remains paramount. There was a third party there, if you listen to the brief, and that would be an amicus brief from the United States. And the United States recommends support for remand and rejection of the moment of threat doctrine. They said the Fifth Circuit's categorical exclusion of pre-threat events violates the totality of the circumstances standard. Pre-threat actions often show whether force was reasonable. And the example they use there, as you'll see in a second, is warnings given to an individual or de-escalation efforts done by the officer, or if the officer manufactured the danger, which is a fancy word to say officer created jeopardy. The United States, in their analysis, provides some guidance to officers, which we'll get a little more into detail, that says officers should be trained to avoid creating situations where the use of force becomes inevitable. However, immediate threats remain the most significant factor. And why I'm a big fan of you listening to this is because there's some key questions from the justices, which is really good for all of you to consider in your analysis, whether you come from the person making the decision or whether you're the supervisor reviewing the use of force or even the force investigator. Justice Alito was the first. He questioned the purpose of examining the totality of the circumstances. You know, he asked, well, what are we examining? And this is a great question. He asked, should the courts assess whether the specific act of using deadly force was reasonable or the officer's overall conduct during the incident was reasonable? Justice Alito said that there's some concerns about introducing subjective elements, such as adherence to departmental police policies and best practices. Justice Kavanaugh, I think, was the one who asked the essential question in this case, and that is, what's an officer supposed to do when someone pulls away from a traffic stop? I'm just going to pause there, because if you're kind of listening, dramatic effect will get you listening again, right? What's an officer supposed to do when someone pulls away from a traffic stop? That's a great question. It's a split-second decision, and there's always the potential that the person could be trying to flee with dangerous intent. Here's what you need to take away from this. They acknowledged, Justice Kavanaugh clearly acknowledged, that the difficulty of providing clear, actionable guidance to officers is what we're all faced with. Split-second decisions are necessary, but reasonableness must always come first. Officers are expected to make decisions in line with the threat at hand, but that doesn't mean that every action is justified in hindsight. Judging the reasonableness of the force used will always come down to a balance, the nature of the threat versus the potential harm caused. Love that. A balance, the nature of the threat versus the potential harm caused. Justice Jackson talked about highlighting inconsistencies in the respondent's shifting stance on whether pre-threat circumstances should be considered, and criticized that the moment of threat doctrine for excluding vital content, citing Judge Higginbotham's observation of that officer's actions, you know, jumping on the car, deserved scrutiny. Now, got to leave some room for Justice Sotomayor, who stated that common law principles that allow consideration of pre-threat actions, such as a case where officers failed to identify themselves, questioned why the Fifth Circuit consistently applies the moment of threat doctrine in a way that benefits officers but exclude evidence against them. And that's something that we expect to hear in Justice Sotomayor's experience. Now, they do use some hypotheticals and some examples that I think are very relevant to getting some realistic application here. They talk about the New Orleans terrorist attack, the hypothetical where an officer jumps in front of a terrorist car and using force would be reasonable due to a compelling state interest. They contrasted this situation with routine traffic stops, where an action may escalate danger unnecessarily. They talked about a plainclothes officer scenario, where an officer failing to identify themselves might provoke a defense response from a suspect, which complicates the analysis of reasonableness. And they talk about the 400 case study, you know, frequent scenarios involving officers jumping in front of cars and then shooting the driver. These Hollywood-style tactics underscore the need for a totality approach. So where do we go from here? And that's the key part. What can you learn from this? As a law enforcement, as I said, you're trained to make split-second decisions. But it's important to recognize that every decision leading up to the threat matters. When you face a dangerous situation, you need to ask yourself, was this the only option available, instead of jumping straight to force? We know that there has to be some key practical takeaways for all of you listening, especially those of you on the front lines. Like, we got to make this applicable for you. Here's the critical question. When faced with a suspect who is pulling away or resisting, what's the best approach? And more importantly, how do you assess whether you're escalating the situation unnecessarily? One of the biggest insights from this case is the need for alternative responses. In Barnes versus Felix, the officer could have pursued in a squad car or radioed for backup. He had the license plate information. At this point, deadly force is a last resort. There's always another option to consider. And this is where we're leaving this now to the Supreme Court. So what do we do? What's some real advice? Well, you know, I'm going to do the best I can as someone who's been focused on use of force for well over 20 years. I'm gonna give you my advice because I don't want to be one of those guys that just leaves you with more things to think about. Where's the backup? Radio for backup. No harm in calling in support. It could give you leverage. You need to manage a situation without escalating. Don't assume the worst. Sometimes pulling away from a traffic stop is not a sign that someone is a criminal, right? The decision to escalate needs to be context-driven, not assumption-driven. Pursuit versus force. We saw in the Barnes case, jumping onto a moving vehicle led to deadly consequences. You know, I wouldn't recommend it. I'm just going to go with that, right? I wouldn't do it. I don't know, by surfing the car is probably not the way to handle the situation. The situation could have been resolved with pursuit or even using non-lethal force in the right circumstances. So when it comes to training, this case offers a valuable opportunity to reflect on how we prepare officers to respond to tense, unpredictable situations. Officers are trained to use force when they're in danger, but they should also be trained not to create situations where the use of force becomes inevitable. And that's what the totality of the circumstance approach is all about. Understanding the context, the buildup, the potential alternatives before you escalate. For example, Texas law enforcement and federal agencies train officers to avoid high-risk maneuvers like jumping onto moving vehicles because it can lead to unintended harm to the officer and civilians alike. So let's wrap this up with a final reflection. When you're out on the job, how do you balance force and reasonableness? This is the question that we're looking for some guidance in from the Supreme Court. How do you balance force and reasonableness? It's about more than just following protocol. It's about thinking through the consequences of your actions. In the case of Barnes versus Felix, the officer's choices created a situation where deadly force seemed inevitable, but it could have been avoided with better options. So, as we look at what we expect from the outcomes, before I give you my wrap-up, well, based on listening to the oral argument, what I expect to see from the Supreme Court in the next month or two is potential outcomes. Well, first, there could be a narrow ruling, right? The court could clarify that pre-threat circumstances must be considered as part of the totality of the circumstances without specifying exact parameters, which will be won't help the issues on the table, right? Because the question that I often ask is, well, how far back? Like, one of the issues that we deal with right now is, especially when someone in crisis, I don't like to use the word mental illness because I don't even know what that means anymore. But I like to use the word in crisis, where someone is not able to make good decisions, right? Incapacitated, as I've dealt with before, my favorite word. Because you could be incapacitated by a lot of things, right? Medical, drugs, alcohol, mental health. It could be many things, right? But the question we often see in those type of cases, well, is what did you know? What should you have known? What could you have known? How far back? That's the issue that I'm worried about without where the court may not identify specific exact parameters how far back. One thing is clear. The job of the Supreme Court is to resolve a circuit split, and they are going to resolve the circuit split. But I believe they are, if I got my tea leaves correct, if I'm reading my crystal ball correctly, I think they're going to resolve the circuit split. They're going to say totality of circumstances is the way to go, and they're going to avoid creating rigid guidelines, which is going to lead to it to go back to the Supreme Court in a couple of years. That will lead to officer training and guidance. A totality approach might require law enforcement agencies to adjust training protocols, continue to emphasize de-escalation, and avoid situations where force becomes inevitable, which means pay attention to what we're discussing on officer-created jeopardy. They're also, just on passing, there is a little impact on qualified immunity, we think. Qualified immunity is going to definitely be impacted by the Supreme Court's ruling, which could influence the scope of qualified immunity by shaping how lower courts analyze reasonableness in use of force cases. So including conclusion for me, I believe the court is likely to reject the Fifth Circuit narrow moment of threat doctrine, favoring a broader totality of the circumstances analysis. So as I leave you, reasonableness isn't just about reacting quickly in the moment. It's about assessing the situation holistically, considering all the options available to you. This case, Barnes versus Felix, is a tough reminder of how critical every decision is in the moments leading up to a use of force situation. Take what you've learned in this podcast and apply it to your training, your mindset, and your work on the street. Now, before I wrap up, I just want to say thank you for tuning in. As I promised you in 2025, we're going to try to up these podcasts just a little bit. I want to thank DLG Learning Center as our sponsor for our Guardian Mindset podcast. I encourage you all to take a look at some of the training programs that are coming up in the near future. There is programs. Number one I'm going to focus you on is going to be the First Amendment Summit, which you can find at firstamendmentsummit.com, being held May 28th through 30th, both in person and virtually, talking about all the First Amendment challenges such as crowd management, protests, public order, social media and free speech, recording police activities, First Amendment auditors and freedom of religion, First Amendment retaliation claims, and whatever else they give us between now and May, that's for sure. I definitely want you to take a look at our upcoming training programs. We have an accreditation manager certification program coming up on February 26th, a one-day tactical operation liability training class coming up on March 20th, and an active de-escalation strategy certification coming up on March 31st, and the background investigation training coming up on April 15th. You can find all those on our dlglearningcenter.com. Hey, everybody, be well, and I will end the way I always do. Help those who need your help. Protect those who need your protection. And most importantly, keep yourself and others safe. Thank you. You can find us at www.dlglearningcenter.com. On the Learning Center, you can find an extensive library of articles, webinars, and online training. Listen, if you find the podcast informative, I'd recommend checking out our weekly Path of the Guardian video training and our monthly supervisory continued education program. These programs can be purchased by single users or department-wide. And if you want easy access to articles and information, please download the Daigle Law Group app through either your Apple App Store or your Google App Store. And remember, help those who need your help, protect those who need your protection, and most importantly, keep yourself and others safe. Thank you.